Natural Solutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
This is Natural Solutions with Dr. J, and I am very excited today to have Michael Ann Conley on as the guest. Now, Michael Ann has, for many, many, many years, she's been helping busy women unwind their anxiety and tame their overwhelm. She's a speaker, private consultant, MFCC, which is a licensed therapist, with a master's degree in holistic health education. Over the last 32 years, she's guided clients and their loved ones who struggle with addiction to find their empowerment and recovery. Her expertise led her to develop the Habits into Health system to help women in all walks of life create healthy habits to keep them calm, confident, and free. Michael Ann's book, Do You Have a Habit or Does Your Habit Have You?, offers options for success. She also shares a part of her own story and useful tips for self-care in the new anthology, Come Out of Hiding and Shine. So, there are these two books, and we were talking a little bit briefly beforehand about your background and that you're going to be doing an upcoming talk on somatic work and using that with addiction for people with addiction who are in recovery for a big clinical conference over in San Francisco. Is that right?
Yes. Well, it's actually a monthly meeting San Francisco of holistic professionals.
Fantastic. Yeah. So, Michael Ann Conley, you run a clinic that is in out here in California also. I'm here practicing clinically in Berkeley, California, and you are over in Lafayette.
Right, about maybe 12 miles east of you.
12 miles, that's right. And so you've been at that location, and you've been in practice for decades, just like I have.
Right. I was licensed in 1991,
fantastic.
Feels like ancient history.
That's right. I was licensed as a licensed acupuncturist in 83. So, now, Michael Ann Conley, this is it's a great name, but the Michael Ann part is, I'm sure everyone, like, they see that and they think, is this, who is this person? No, you also have a nickname, M.A., right?
Right.
No, who calls you
M.A. for short. Some of my friends, some of my clients, it's my nickname, M.A. My dad is the first person who called me M.A. when I was a kid. My mom gave me the name Michael Ann, but my dad gave me my nickname M.A.
I see. And your dad's name is Michael?
No. I was named for my mother's father.
Oh, your mother's father. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
And then she liked the combination because it sounded well?
She liked the way that Michael Ann rolled. She liked the name Michael for a woman, and she liked the way Ann worked with it. And she decided this long before she met my father.
Oh, interesting.
She decided that she was going to name her first daughter Michael Ann.
Oh, and you are the first?
I am the first of many.
All right. You're not the only.
No.
Not the only daughter, no. So, did you grow up in the South, or?
No, although we moved to the South. I was born in Alaska.
Wow.
And when we only lived there for 10 months, my dad was a mining engineer, and at that time he was a mining engineering student, graduated from the University of Alaska, and he had a job down in New Mexico. So I spent most of my early years, we moved a lot back and forth between New Mexico and Arizona. But when I was a teenager, we moved to Tennessee. So I came of age into young adulthood in the South. And it's not uncommon for women to have double names that are
exactly.
A male name and a female name. Bobby,
exactly.
Sue,
that's,
you know, that kind of name.
That's why I was
so,
yeah. the South. Or is your mother from the South? Or?
No. She was from Connecticut. Nothing makes sense, Jay. It's all very interesting.
It's so fascinating.
There's no logic to any of this.
When I was growing up, my father's name was John, and I was also John. But so I became J.R. And then in the first grade, a teacher of mine named me Jay. And I don't know why my first grade teacher had such an influence on my name from then on. But that's so I used to be a abbreviation name also, like you have N.A. Yeah.
That's great.
Very interesting. So when we met at a functional medicine forum in Berkeley.
Right.
And this was a few months ago, I think. Uh-huh. And we were sitting there and chatting, and this is a functional medicine forum. So in talking about the possibility of doing a podcast together, we have so many different things in common related to our backgrounds and long history of seeing the development of functional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
What is now called functional medicine, but it actually wasn't called functional medicine many years ago. So what would you say, what are some of your first remembrances or thoughts about the change and development of this particular field?
Well, let me go back a ways because, I was telling you earlier, I have a license as a marriage and family therapist, but I don't have a degree in psychology. And this has ended up being a very positive thing. Because I came to the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, to go to school. I had been looking for a master's program in nutrition counseling because I wanted to be my joke was I wanted to teach people to eat their broccoli. This was back in an era, you know, in the 70s, holistic health, holistic health was really hot in the 70s, and people were learning all kinds of new and different things, and I had had some dietary issues, and I got interested in cooking differently. And it was really, really fascinating to me. And I had always loved school, so I decided I wanted to go back to school. But what I found was that all the master's programs that I looked at were teaching people to be dietitians in hospitals.
Aha.
Well, who wanted that? You know, I mean.
Yeah, so that's not, like registered dietitian route.
Yeah. Yes, right. And you know, and I've since met some registered dietitians who went in the holistic route. But for me, I didn't come out of I wasn't very good in science and math. And so I didn't have, that kind of scientific training wasn't what I was interested in. I was really more interested in helping people. And so that's when I had my first exposure, I was doing a lot of self-study. I didn't start my degree program until 81. So in the late 70s, in the late 70s, I was actually traveling. I actually had moved to New Orleans, and I had an opportunity to go on a little trip back out west. And the trip was supposed to last 3 weeks. And I've only been back to visit New Orleans since. So life changed. And I had this opportunity to just really explore. I was in my late 20s, and I was making a change. I had been a journalist, and I was making a transition into a different profession. And so I got just so fascinated with holistic health and nutrition, and really just wanted to help people, because I had helped myself. Of course, you know, we start with ourselves. And one of the people who influenced
excuse me, so you had some food allergies or something?
I had food allergies as a kid. I was allergic as a kid to watermelon and walnuts.
Huh.
But I didn't have a lot of you know, there was a lot of things we didn't know about food allergies and sensitivity.
Yeah, yeah.
But when
I
was a young...
Were you
allergic to W's? Say W's? You mean wheat?
W. You said it's walnuts and watermelon. I thought, or W-A's. Maybe foods that start with a W-A.
I don't know. It's very strange. All I just know is as a kid, instead of watermelon, I was the one who got the ice cream.
Oh.
And ice cream is my drug of choice. So I have a personal harm reduction program for myself around ice cream. The combination of dairy and sugar is really not great. And we now know it's not great for anybody, you know.
That's true. That's true. It's not good for our bodies in general. I mean, I love ice cream, too. I grew up in the Midwest having ice cream.
Yeah, that's
what you
did.
There's some very,
very
fancy ice creams that exist now.
Yeah, yeah. But when I was a journalist, I had this experience. I didn't realize it was harming me, but I was eating pretty badly. I loved French fries. French fries and ice cream, that's a great diet, right? And,
it's part of the sad diet.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Standard
and my
American
fluid,
diet.
My fluid intake was primarily Dr. Pepper.
Wow.
And this is before... I'm listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, at least it was medicinal. I mean, Dr. Pepper has some herbs and things in it, right?
Well, exactly. But this was before diet drinks were developed. You know, there was... I remember when they made the switch. They made the switch from regular Dr. Pepper to diet Dr. Pepper. And I realized that, you know, I just didn't like the aftertaste of these diet drinks.
Right.
So... You know, so I was into the hard stuff, and I was working at a newspaper in Memphis, and that's Memphis, Tennessee, for those of you who are not in the States, and I would drink the equivalent of a six-pack of Dr. Pepper a day.
Well, that's pretty common back then. Even now, there's a lot of people who drink that.
A lot of people who do that, right? And I always had this gnawing in my stomach, and I thought it was because I was hungry. So I'd go, the gnawing would start, I'd go down to the vending machine, I'd get the Dr. Pepper from one vending machine, and I'd get crackers from another.
Perfect combination.
You know, perfect combination, you know. And then I'd go home, and I did have little veggie plates and things like that, but I had my own personal French fry cooker, and I would chop up my potatoes and eat my French fries. I mean, I was killing myself, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in my 20s, you know. So I had a friend, we actually lived together, and she decided to lose weight. So she found out about this fancy diet that was I think it was a no carbohydrate, low fat diet. And in solidarity, I said, hey, I'll do this with you. She was going to do it for 30 days. I said, oh, I can do anything for 30 days. Let's eat together and we can be buddies together. Well, the food was actually horrible, but so we didn't last 30 days.
It was broccoli.
But actually, it was some kind of. She had to cook things that had gelatin, and it was very weird. It was very weird. But there were vegetables, including broccoli, which I actually like. But in order to do this diet, you know, I should have investigated it first, right? Because
yeah,
I had
because
to give
French
up.
French fries are cooked in fat, right?
I had to give up French fries, and I had to give up Dr. Pepper.
And ice cream.
No. Well, I don't remember the ice cream part, but
you
probably.
There was no fat in it.
Yeah.
But.
So all of a sudden, I stopped drinking Dr. Pepper. Oh, I can do this for 30 days, you know. And the gnawing in my stomach stopped.
Oh, how long did that take?
Oh, probably 2 or 3 days, not very long at all, you know, and so we didn't last 30 days on the diet because the food was horrific, but immediately after that, okay, I go back to Dr. Pepper, and guess what happens? The gnawing in my stomach starts up again.
Ah.
So that was a clue, and then I gave up the French fry cooker.
Uh-huh.
That was really sad.
That must have been quite a difficult thing to do.
Well, it was, you know, because I was realizing, oh my goodness, what I'm putting in my mouth is affecting me. And it was real.
Yes.
It was real time, you know. It was not good. So then I became interested, and you know, in of all places, I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, which is, you know, considered the capital of the Mid South. It's not exactly a progressive place to live, but I had a friend who had gone to school at the University of Iowa. And
is
she was learning all of.
Is?
Oh, in no, the Grand Ole Opry is in Nashville, in Middle Tennessee.
Oh, Nashville, yeah.
Yeah, I have friends. Memphis is on the river, honey. Definitely on the river. I lived in Memphis for 4 years.
On the Mississippi.
On the Mississippi, overlooking the Mississippi River. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think I was there once or twice, and a number of years ago, my oldest daughter's like 22 now, and when she was maybe 5, I was on a trip there, and when I came back, she said, where were you, Daddy? I said, Memphis. She said, Memphis? She thought that was the funniest name in the world. I don't know why. But anyway, that's my
memory. Well, you know, it's Memphis after the ancient city of Memphis.
Oh, okay.
In Egypt.
All right.
Think of it in Egypt.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But you wouldn't think that this, you know, relative, it was a big city in that area. It's between Little Rock and Nashville and St. Louis and Jackson or New Orleans, you know. But I had a friend from college who had gone to school in Ames, Iowa, and she was learning all about holistic health. And every time her parents lived in Memphis, and every time she came to Memphis to visit her parents, we'd hang out. And so I was learning about holistic health in Memphis, Tennessee, of all places.
Yeah.
And so I got this interest. And changing my diet changed everything. So it gave me this new lease on life and an interest in doing something different than what I was doing in journalism. Once I started into that, I learned, and where I'm going with this is, one of the first people who influenced me was Jeffrey Bland, who turns out over the years he stuck with nutrition. He was a writer, he was a teacher. There was a lot of materials out there. He was one of the early people that was really talking about nutrition. There were others, Adele Davis, Gary Null. Jeffrey Bland was one of those people. And Jeffrey Bland ended up evolving nutritional studies into what is now called functional medicine.
That's right.
There we go.
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember when I moved out to California in 1983 and sat for the acupuncture exams. Right around that time was when I first got introduced to Jeffrey Bland and Metagenics and their products. And and so it's been quite a long time, and going to many of his lectures is one of the things where there's some really brilliant people, and every word has so much significance. And so I go to those lectures and he would say a couple things, and then I go, oh, yeah, that makes me think of something. And if I didn't stay totally focused on what he's saying, he'd be in this totally next place that was really significant. I'd be off thinking about this, and it's like, no, stay focused. Stay, what's he talking about? And it's really, there's so much there. It's like,
right?
You know, I highly respect the work that he's done for many, 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 many
Absolutely.
Years. But anyway, yeah, he's one of the pioneers.
Well, You came here in 83.
That's right.
And where did you come from?
I was living in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia at the time. I was there for about 4.5 years, and I was doing a post baccalaureate pre-health program, which was essentially as a pre-med program for people who already had bachelor's degrees. But I was working for the National Cancer Institute, translating Japanese research on cancer. There's a lot of researchers who would do, we'd look through journals and things like that and find the articles that were related to cancer. And I was doing the Japanese side of it. So we would have to read the article and then do an abstract of it for the National Research Database.
Right.
And then eventually that project was killed by Ronald Reagan. And it was At that point, I was ready to move, and I was studying acupuncture and taking courses in Maryland so that I would be qualified to sit for a licensing exam. And at that point, there were only 5 states in the country where it was licensed, and California was one of them, and Pennsylvania was not. So I moved out of California to practice acupuncture.
Right. Well, I actually, the person who was the founder and chair of my program here in the Bay Area, because I came in 81, because I had seen an ad in New Age magazine for John F. Kennedy University, and they had a degree in clinical holistic health education, and one of the majors within that program was nutrition counseling.
So I interviewed
Richard Miles, Richard B. Miles, is the person who created that program in holistic health education at JFK University. And it turns out we became great friends for years and years. He's now transitioned out of the body, but we were friends for many, many years. And it turns out he played a role in bringing acupuncture to the United States.
Ah, very interesting.
Yeah. He and a friend, this is back in, the way he would tell it, it was kind of funny. He would say, well, back in the early 70s, a friend of mine and I decided to host a conference about acupuncture. We were interested in it, and we had about 200 doctors that were going to come. They had started this little business doing workshops. And then he said, and then Nixon went to China. Well, when Nixon went to China...
Exactly, James Reston had surgery.
James Reston had surgery and reported on what happened.
Part of it. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So then Richard said, well, we had this space for 200 physicians and thousands. We had 2,000 physicians come to this conference.
Oh, that's fascinating. And, I've never heard that story before.
Yeah, and it was here in the Bay Area. It was here in the San Francisco area. I think he was down in San Jose, Palo Alto, that area there.
Huh.
So he and his friend created this company called Crossroads Communication, and they started bringing in all kinds of people who were doing things. I imagine, I don't know, he didn't mention Jeffrey Bland, but I wouldn't be surprised if Jeffrey Bland was a part of that. Everybody who was on the leading edge of healthcare was coming to the San Francisco area at that time and creating this new model. Well, it's not a new model. It's like taking, it was new to the United States. Let's be clear about that. You know that, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, because acupuncture, Chinese medicine, is not alternative medicine. We have this word that's used to compartmentalize forms of healthcare that come out of other traditions as if there's some alternative. They're sort of outside the scope of the medicine that we're supposed to follow. And back in the 70s, when you and I were youngsters, all of this was really hot. It was happening.
That's true.
And
Rodale Press has been around for a long, long time. And
in Pennsylvania,
Standard Process. There have been a lot of things that have been hot or at least just continuous. It's like the quote-unquote alternative medicine arena has been continuous for centuries. And in the U.S., there's various time periods where it just became suppressed. Like homeopathy was the predominant form of of Western medicine up until, I don't know, I think maybe early 1800s or something in the U.S. or a little,
the book When Healing Became a Crime about the Hoxie cancer cure. I'm forgetting the name of the author. It's one of the founders of the Bioneers. He wrote this incredible book. And as part of this book, he writes about the history of how what we call, what is called Western medicine, or I call it conventional medicine. It's been called allopathic medicine, how it started as basically a political movement in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, and basically demonized homeopathy, chiropractic, and people like Hoxie and other people who are actually finding natural cures for cancer, And they managed to get the laws passed. So they were like, you know, they were in bed with the politicians, and they demonized and called folks who were doing natural medicine quacks, and it ended up silencing a lot of voices.
That's very true. So it is a much longer history. I know that like B.J. Palmer, I believe, was, because he was, I think it was B.J., as one of the founders of chiropractic, he was really connected with politicians, and if he hadn't been, chiropractic would have been totally squashed. My grandfather on my mother's side was a chiropractor, and he had in Indiana, and he had studied in with Palmer's in Iowa. So then my uncle, who I respect both of them very much. My uncle also was a surgeon who I worked with him at age 18 as a surgical assistant, assisted in like 50 some surgeries. This was in Indianapolis, 1971. And that was an incredible experience. But my grandfather, who was my aunt's father and my mother's father, he was the chiropractor. So there was a chiropractor and a Western medical doctor, and they didn't really see eye to eye. You know, neither one of them was really like, I don't know. Very interesting growing up. I didn't really realize that until later on. But there was that antipathy going on. But I think B.J. Palmer used to like have elephants and parades with elephants down the streets in Iowa and things like that. Mm-hmm. And was strong, well connected with politicians in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so that helped to keep them from having to go totally underground. But at any rate, it has been going on for a long time, and we've both been around since the 70s and studying these things. Like the college I went to, Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana, was Francis Moore LePay is a graduate.
I didn't know that.
Small Planet.
Yeah.
And my senior year, I went to a talk that she gave at the school. And it was one of the reasons why I decided to become, well, I was a fishitarian. I wasn't completely vegetarian or vegan. But why I decided to do that for, I don't know, it was about a third of my life, was because of that. Because Diet for a Small Planet, which is a very significant book as well.
Right,
in,
right. Well, yes.
Functional
medicine,
fact, nutrition arena.
I was very influenced by her as well, although I never knew her in person. When I came here to go to school, I had about 18 months where I had to do prerequisites. And during that time, I wasn't quite sure exactly how I was going to apply my degree. So I decided that I would volunteer my time to different people or projects that were involved somehow in nutrition to see whether to see what area I was to go in. And so I volunteered to work for Food First. And I had, because of my journalism background, I was able to bring some that experience in. And I worked with one of the staff members there for, actually it was probably longer than 6 weeks. And it actually, her book really sensitized me to the politics of nutrition. One of the most important things that she said that really hit me is that you know whether a nation is has integrity by how it feeds its people. And I just thought that everything that she was about was just so right on. And it really brought the nutrition aspect and the political aspect together. I was so impressed with her.
At Food First. So you finished up you decided to go into nutrition, or what, a certain aspect of nutrition is based on that, you said?
Well, I wasn't, you know, I think I was shaping where I was supposed to go. And actually, my time at Food First, I found myself thinking, oh my God, I can't with integrity in myself teach people to eat their broccoli when their broccoli has been watered with food, with water that has pesticides in it.
Fascinating.
So it began to give me pause about whether I could, with integrity, be a nutrition counselor. I had my experience in journalism came up in the late 60s and early 70s during a very political era. Journalists were telling the truth about the Vietnam War, and you know, the New York Times was publishing the Pentagon Papers, and so it was a very politicized era where journalism was, it fed a part of me, and so I have this activist in me, and so it began to actually quiet my experience with Food First. Didn't change my interest in nutrition, but it began to quiet the part of me that thought that, oh, I can just go and tell people to eat right, and everything's going to be okay.
What do you mean by that? It started to quiet it. You started realizing.
Well, I began to question my direction. I began to look at, okay, what is happening here? And it turned out that about simultaneously, I got into the master's program, and the person who was in charge of that particular component of the program, I realized she didn't have what I needed. That I could learn and continue to study nutrition on my own. I had, when I first moved here in 81, I met Eddie Bowman, and he's the founder of Bowman, with now Bowman University, that trains people to be nutrition counselors. He was really avidly involved in the Berkeley Holistic Health Center back in the late 70s and 80s. And so we connected, and we had started a study group, and so I was all interested in that. But then I really began to look at, how is it that people change? You know, I mean, what was it that catalyzed me making a change in my diet, for instance? But what about other ways that people change? And so as I got into the master's program, I realized the nutrition piece I could continue to do as a self-study. But that also, you know, I was a journalist, and as a journalist, you interview people, but you're not really present with people. You're not really... You move from one interviewee to another, and you're not really in relationship with them. And I became more fascinated with how I could begin to change myself from a deeper place that wasn't specifically about nutrition. So a whole bigger field opened up for me during that year and a half, because I volunteered at other places too. I ended up volunteering for 6 weeks at a center that was creating a database of, this is a database before computers, you know, this, well, before most of us had computers. It was in the early 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
well, the early 80s was when personal computers started, and they were very expensive, because I moved to California, I borrowed money from my mother and my aunt and uncle in order to buy a computer, so I could do Japanese translation while I was transitioning into natural medicine. And it cost $3,000 just for like a real, I mean, I sort of collect these things, so I still have it, but it had 256K.
Oh, yeah.
256K disk drives, and there wasn't a hard drive. It was just all on floppy disk. That was expensive back then. And so that was the early age, and that was before, so that was like in 1983.
I think
was one of the first PCs. So,
yeah, the Mac came out in 84.
Yeah.
So it was the first computer that appealed to me. But back then, you know, there was no computer. But they were creating.
Yeah, so you were doing data accumulation.
They were creating basically a referral network for addiction treatment. And so I began to be interested in alcohol and drug addiction, which also, you know, alcohol is fermented sugar.
True.
And, you know, it originated as it's a food substance, which of course has changed over the years, particularly when distillation kicked in the 1600s. but it was also a substance that people took in, and it had an effect on their ability to function. So I became interested in alcoholism and drugs and things like that through that. So I was exploring these different, volunteering for these different organizations, began to reconsider how I wanted to use my degree. And then what evolved from that is I had to have an internship in my program. I had to have a 9-month internship program. And I became more and more interested in alcoholism, but we only had like a 3-unit class in our program in addiction. And
so that's like also, a three hours a week class or something, right?
Yeah, it was a 3-hour a week class. It was very minimal, and a friend of mine taught the class, so it wasn't appropriate for me to be in a class that was taught by someone who was a friend. And it turned out that, well, it was just a personal relationship, and so it just didn't feel appropriate. But what happened,
I was joking about the failing part.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to fail. I wasn't failing.
I'm
I was
sure
doing
you
pretty
fail
good.
Any class. Yeah.
That's actually not exactly true. I failed Math 111 twice as an undergraduate.
All right.
The beginning math, I failed twice. So I ended
That's
up getting a B.
That's why you aren't on the high science, high math.
I'm not on the high science math. Yeah, yeah. Which is why pre-med was not going to be my direction.
Right.
It had to be something else.
Yeah.
So I had three things happen in 1 week that clarified the direction, because I was really continuing to think about, oh, alcohol, I need to know more about this. And a friend of mine told me that they had another program at the university that had a certificate program in alcohol and drug treatment. And
this was a JFK.
That week, it was a JFK. So I scheduled an appointment for Thursday. Well, on Tuesday, Newsweek, I got Newsweek every week. I was an avid Newsweek reader. And the cover story was about alcoholism. So on Tuesday, I'm like drinking in this article about alcoholism. On Thursday, I go to interview to find out about this alcohol and drug certificate program in another psychology program at JFK University. And I find out that from the director that all of the classes will qualify me for the marriage and family therapy license.
So
there is this shift of things that's happening. So I get accepted into the alcohol and drug treatment program on Thursday. And then on Saturday, I went to a party that some friends of mine had put together. They didn't tell me that they were putting it together because they wanted to introduce me to a guy. They didn't tell him that they were throwing the party because they wanted to introduce him to a girl. You know? And they had tried to fix this up on a blind date, and both of us had said, no, I'm not going on any blind date. So they threw this little party and invited both of us, and the party was solely for the intention of seeing if we clicked. And we ended up clicking, and it turns out that this was a person we dated for about 6 months. He's a great guy, and he had been in recovery. He was a recovering alcoholic with about 3 years clean and sober, and he worked for an alcohol and drug treatment facility, and he helped me get my internship. So within 1 week, I had all of these signals that were coming to me about, boom, this is where you're going to go. So I did this internship through a group called Horizon House, Inc., and I ended up teaching. I worked at Chrysalis House, and I ended up teaching I created a class on nutrition for recovery at Chrysalis House. And then I'm doing other work in an outpatient program that they had in Hayward that was more conventional mental health, getting my hours for my degree program. So I was able to bring the nutrition piece together with my new interest in really, really learning how people change and have it be in an area of mental health that was much more open to holistic health principles than any other area of mental health that I had come across.
So where were you doing the internship in Hayward?
It was Horizon House, Inc., and they just had a little outpatient program down there. It, you know, no longer exists. But my friend worked for Cronin House, which was back then it was called social model treatment. People, it was a, you know, live-in. People would come. It wasn't a medical model. It was social model, meaning that they came to a program. They lived there for, you know, 30 to 45 days, sometimes a little bit longer, and they got a chance to be educated about alcoholism, to have a period of time clean and sober. And it was all very, a lot of them were very AA focused, Alcoholics Anonymous focused. So it was helping people transform their lives. And I got to do, you know, I did a workshop down there on nutrition for recovery, and then I taught my class at Crystal's house for a year. It was very exciting.
That's great. Yeah. I've been, since I had some individuals who invited me to be on the board of directors of HEART. Do you know HEART? It's Humanistic Alternative to Addiction Research and Therapy.
Oh, yes. As a methadone clinic, yes. Actually, I had a friend who worked there at HEART. She was, I don't know if she's one of the founders, but she was one of the early early people. Yeah, at HEART. They were doing methadone from methadone treatment.
Yeah, so I've been on the board of directors of that for, I don't know, 20-plus years. Yeah.
So
I know a little bit about addiction, not the world's expert, though, not like you.
Well, it landed for me. It was something that worked, even though I brought in my holistic perspective, and my coworkers would say, "Wow, that's really great. Can we borrow that?" And I'd say, "Sure." And then they would say things, and I would go, "Wow, that's really great. Can I borrow that?" And they'd say, "Sure." So there was just a natural blend. We were talking about the same things, but using different language.
That's right.
You know, because addiction treatment has always been, it's not as holistic. I would like to see addiction treatment become much more integrative. I'd like to see more functional medicine involved in working with addiction treatment. But from the perspective of working with many multiple aspects, the multiple aspects of a human being, addiction treatment has always done that. They're looking at the spiritual side of self. They're looking at vocational issues. They're looking at relationship issues. They're looking at the medical and health issues around the effect of alcohol and drugs. They're looking at friendship networks. They're looking at self-care. So it's always been a comprehensive. What hasn't quite happened, it's starting to happen, that more and more addiction facilities are doing more holistic treatment. From an integrative, they haven't quite got on board, I don't think, with functional medicine, but I sure would like to see that happen.
Yeah, I know that in the whole arena of vitamin therapy and things, it was forever ago when the study was done as far as, I think, is it schizophrenia or something, that certain B vitamins in higher doses actually made significant differences and things like that. I think it was Abrams or somebody like that did a study on that. And I know just recently at one of the functional medicine forums, there were presentations on integrative psychiatry or psychology.
Yes, that was actually the one where we met.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that, again, is an arena where it would be great if functional medicine was more integrated into the system, as you're talking about, because there's a huge potential that could be an added viewpoint and added input that could significantly improve outcomes as well.
Right. Well, and I also, in 2010, I had met Julia Ross many years ago when she was running the Henry Olaf House, which is an addiction treatment facility that was in San Francisco. And she became interested in what's going on with people who can't, they go into treatment programs and they go in three and four times and something's not happening for them. And so she began to develop her understanding of a role that amino acids play in helping people stay sober. And so she created the neuronutrient path to helping people with recovery, not just from alcoholism, but also dietary issues and mood, anxiety and depression. And so she created her training program based in Mill Valley. And so I did her training program in about 2010, to really, really again, grapple with what is the nutritional component of helping people who appear to have mental health issues, but there's really something else going on. And it often starts in the gut.
Very true. Or at least it can spread to the gut.
And it spreads to the gut.
Nutritional deficiencies will influence the gut and vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when I think of here we are in 2017 and functional medicine is beginning to interest more and more doctors who've been trained in conventional medicine, but get virtually no training in nutrition in medical school. And the evolution of naturopathy, which is now legal when I actually wanted to become a naturopath, but you could only practice as a naturopath in Washington and Oregon back in the day when I was exploring these options. And I am a depressive type. I'm vulnerable to depression. And I knew that the cloud cover and the rain on the rainy side of Oregon and Washington was something I could manage for, you know, the 5 or 6 years of school, but that I wouldn't want to live there permanently. It was not a place that I could actually manage to live. I knew enough about myself to know that. And I had grown up in the desert with the allergies that I had were not prime. I mean, I had the watermelon and walnuts, but my primary allergies were respiratory allergies for things that grew in the desert. And so the eastern side of the mountains in Washington and Oregon also were not going to be suitable. So I let go of the interest in becoming a naturopath. And yet, naturopathy now is legally practiced in California and in other states. And that's for doctors who want to focus on nutrition as their primary focus, rather than doing they get the same medical training, except they don't do the surgical rotation. They don't do the psychiatric rotation. You know, they just, their focus is nutrition. So all of these pieces, here we are in 2017. It feels like we're all late to the party around this because I've been steeped in this for 40 years, right? 1977?
That's right.
Feels like, oh my God, why isn't this, it's starting to happen, but why is it still starting to happen? Do you ever get that feeling, Jay?
Yeah, it's certainly, we both have been educated in these realms and using it with individuals, and yet it's, for many functional medicine people, it's there are a few people where it's really taken off, but for a lot of us others, we aren't as fully booked as we should be, given what we are able to help people with.
And, mm-hmm.
I think that is also related to the way the medical system set up, or quote unquote healthcare system set up, as far as insurance reimbursement and things like that too. So,
right? There's still a price that's being paid for those political decisions that were made with the onset of the American Medical Association.
Yeah, and
more than 100 years ago.
Certainly the price is in decreased health in the general population and increased healthcare costs due to degenerative disease.
Right.
And the degenerative diseases that end up being the end of life heroic efforts that could have been mitigated by changes earlier on using naturopathic medicine and a wide variety of other approaches.
Right. And so for me, this is actually a social justice issue. because only the wealthy have, or even upper middle class, can afford to pay for the treatments that functional medicine has to offer. And so there's many different levels of this that can be really frustrating. I'm very excited that more and more medical doctors are learning about and beginning to practice functional medicine, and they're understanding the nutritional basis of health and disease. But it's not, we're still battling with the institutionalization. And of course, the conversation that's happening nationally, even right now, it's not about care, it's about cost. We've never really fully had a conversation about health care that's really about care. Otherwise, functional medicine and what it brings to the table, and neuronutrient ways of working with alcoholism and addiction, and naturopathy would be a part of truly integrative medicine, from my point of view.
Yes, I think so much more emphasis needs to be made in that arena, and certainly I hope that podcasts and conversations like we've had today will help to enhance and broaden that education that people have about the opportunities that and the possibilities that natural medicine and functional medicine could have in their own health and in the health of people who they love and cherish and would like to be as alert and engaged through their entire life as possible. Because one of the things that, as you know, I've written a couple books on the brain and on Alzheimer's dementia, and it is one of those arenas. One in three people dies with dementia, and one in six people have Alzheimer's or will have Alzheimer's, and that is approaching some of the statistics related to heart attacks, cardiovascular deaths from cardiovascular illness and things like that, and its connection with diabetes and blood sugar problems is really pivotal, and we have a huge problem, literally a huge problem in obesity in this country.
Obesity.
So, and those are all arenas which functional medicine and nutritional approaches have extremely significantly positive impacts on. So that's why I'm so excited to be able to speak with you and share our experiences and also share in the functional medicine forums together. So any last words you would like to give or words of wisdom? You have so much to offer the listening audience. Any parting words you would like to make?
Well, I'm really excited. I love having this kind of conversation with someone like you, Jay, who's been steeped in this as long as I have. And we have this long history that many people don't hear about or know about in recognizing that there is no need to be afraid of these new medicines because they aren't new. They have been around for years, and for you know, any of your listeners that are concerned about whether there's any science behind it, to understand that there is a lot of science behind these nutritionally based treatments, and that to not be afraid to give it a try, because otherwise you're going to end up on having surgery or some other, you know, and there's a place for conventional medicine. It's really, really good at helping us with structural kinds of issues, and there are new things that are happening there too that are very exciting. But to not be afraid to try these other methods that come out of functional medicine, because it's not only going to help your health in your body, but your body contains the mind. And so it has an effect on what you think of as mental health, which is not separate from whole health. And that's, I think, the most important thing about what we do, Jay, what I see, and you call it natural medicine. It's been called nutritional medicine, or it's called holistic medicine or integrative medicine, whatever word we call it by, it really is here to serve. And I just want to invite people to really consider learning more and more about how they can help themselves in ways before it gets to a serious issue.
Well, with those great words of wisdom, I want to thank you once again for sharing your wealth of knowledge and your overview of the history of the past 40 years that we've both been involved in this field. And I encourage listeners to go to the blog so you can get more information about Michael Ann Conley and her books and her practice, and as well as my practice and my books. And so with that, this is Natural Solutions with Dr. J. We're excited that you are working on your health, and we're excited to have you join us for the next podcast. Thanks so much.
To buy your copy of Superbrain, Maximize Your Brain Health for a Better Life, go to superbrain-thebook.com. That's superbrain-thebook.com. Information can also be found on naturalsolutionswithdrj.com.